Clerk will note the roll. There is a quorum. Members, the business before us today is the eminent domain bill. But first, let's take the minutes. I've got the minutes of the last meeting, Wednesday, March 29th, before us. Are there any corrections, additions, or changes to those minutes? Representative Biskins moves approval of the minutes. All in favor of approval of the minutes, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The minutes are approved. Members, I have Representative Johnson here to present the eminent domain bill, and the chair will first move Senate File 2750, and then I think we need to substitute the House language. Is that correct, Representative Johnson?
Yes, please, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, the chair moves that House File 2846 be substituted for the language in Senate File 2750. Any discussion? All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Johnson, welcome to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I will dispense with my usual spiel because since this is my sixth or seventh stop, almost everyone in here has probably already heard it. And what I think I'll do is just walk through the bill. You want my spiel? Or would you rather?
Yes, you haven't heard it.
All right, I'll give it to you.
Popular demand, we want the spiel. Right. But before we get the spiel, did you want me to do an author's amendment to Representative Johnson?
Would you please, Mr. Chairman?
Okay, and that is the A-74 amendment,
right.
Is that correct?
That's right.
Okay, chair moves the A-74 amendment. Representative Johnson, can you tell us about the A-74 amendment?
Mr. Chairman, that actually has quite a few different small pieces. Most of them are not substantive, a couple are, and it puts the bill into the form I'd like, and as I walk through the bill, then, if we could put this on, I can just explain it as changed.
You know, Representative Johnson, this bill has gone through a number of committees, and I guess if there are some substantive things in here, I think I'd prefer to have the discussion about it before, without just putting it on.
Okay, well, how
I
about...
I either go through the bill without it, or else, I guess I didn't realize there were substantive items in here. I guess you can... talk about it right now if you want the amendment, or we can go through the bill and then talk about it, however you wish.
Why don't we go through the bill, and then I will explain as we get to each of these changes where it would be in the bill, and then we could vote on the amendment afterwards.
Okay.
We have been, I'll give you the 45-second version of my spiel, Mr. Chairman. We've been working on this for months, actually since late last summer when I first introduced a one-sentence bill or a two-sentence bill, and several other people did too, and... this bill is, frankly, quite different, in detail at least, from what I first introduced. It's similar or really the same in the two basic principles in the bill. And those two basic principles are that if government needs to take property for a traditional public use, such as a road or a school or a government building or a park, we don't want to stand in the way of that, but we do have provisions in here that make certain that a fair or just price is paid for that and deal with some of the procedural issues there. The other principle is that if government needs to take property for economic development, it ought to be very difficult to do so. Not impossible. And we've made it. We've made a lot of changes in this bill to make sure that it is still possible and that it still can be used as a tool. But it should be difficult, and it should only be done if there's something significantly wrong with the property. Those are the two basic principles. They've stayed the same. The details have changed in some cases considerably to address some, I think, legitimate concerns by governmental entities and developers in some cases. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I will walk through the bill, and I will point out the changes that I would like to make in my author's amendment as we go through this. Starting with Section 1 on page 1, that simply states that the language in the bill is preemptive of other laws that might deal with eminent domain. That's Subdivision 1. Subdivision 2 simply states that there is no implied authority for a governmental entity to take through eminent domain unless it's actually specifically given. And Subdivision 3, the extraterritorial use prohibited, or as Chairman Davids called it, the extraterrestrial use prohibited, was something that we added in the Agriculture Committee, and it says that a condemning authority can't exercise its eminent domain rights outside of its own jurisdiction without getting the permission from the jurisdiction that they're taking from, which surprised many of us that anybody could even do that, but now we've at least dealt with that. The next page, the next two pages, well, actually...
Excuse me, a question for that, Representative Dempsey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative, could you give me an example?
Mr. Chairman?
On subdivision number 3?
Of the extraterrestrial taking?
Yes.
Representative Johnson.
Representative Dempsey, my understanding is that this has to do sometimes with cities versus townships and a city being able to use eminent domain to take property in a township without the township's permission. That's my understanding.
Madam?
Representative Dempsey.
And Representative, and so that is new legislation now. Am I correct in that? And
yes. Yes, Mr. Chairman, Representative Dempsey, the language is new, and what is new about it is that the government entity that's doing the taking has to get permission from the government entity that actually has jurisdiction over that piece of property.
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you. Do you want questions for clarification as we go?
Well, I was just debating about that, if I should maybe just let Representative Johnson go through his explanation of the bill and then let people ask questions. Since you have the floor, if you have one, go ahead, Representative Wagenius.
I would thank you, Mr. Chair. Back on subdivision 2, where you say no implied authority, help me along with how does that relate to inverse condemnation?
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Wagenius, I'm not sure that it does. Essentially what this says is that a government entity or an entity of any sort cannot take a piece of property through eminent domain unless they're actually given the authority to do it. And there are, I believe, many statutes out there that give a lot of different government entities the power to take through eminent domain. But I'm not sure how it would be different under inverse condemnation. I'm not exactly certain where you're going with that.
Representative Wagenius.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure where I'm going either, but it seems to me that government can do takings through inverse condemnation, and I'm just trying to see how that relates, and that's what I'm trying to get at.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Wagenius, this wouldn't change that. This just simply says that you can't have an entity out there that doesn't otherwise have the power to take, who now can take because there's some implied authority that a court finds, for example, even though they've never been given statutory authority. But any governmental entity that has the authority can do it either way.
Thank you.
No, I've got a Representative Solberg next. Then I think we maybe should just let Representative Johnson go through the bill, because I see even the author's amendment deals with some things such as this particular section.
Well, Mr. Chairman,
so Representative Solberg.
That's what I was asking, because I see your author's amendment is deleting that section and adding something different. So
yeah. Let's let Representative Johnson present the whole bill, since this is a longer, complex bill, and then perhaps people can save their questions and we can handle things more expeditiously that way. So, Representative Johnson.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If we turn to page 2, you will see there's 2 pages of definitions here, and I'm not going to walk through them in order. I want to walk through them in a way that makes a little more sense. So if you turn to page 3, line 3.19, that's kind of the guts of the bill. This is the definition of public use, and our Constitution says that government cannot take property through eminent domain except for a public use, and courts have expanded that to a public purpose. So we have given a specific definition of what public use or public purpose are, and there are 3 things under subdivision 11. The first one is the possession, occupation, ownership, and enjoyment of the land by the general public. That's our traditional definition. That's a road, that's a park, that's a school, that's anything that's owned by the government and can be used by the public. The creation or functioning of a public service corporation is utilities, I believe railroads are in there, airports. That is considered a public use or a public purpose under this new statute. And then the biggie, number 3, we have 4 examples of non-traditional public use where government can still step in and use its power of eminent domain for economic development, for example. And those are the mitigation of a blighted area, the remediation of an environmentally contaminated area, the reduction of abandoned property, or the removal of a public nuisance. And I will refer to the definitions of each of those 4 because this is a very important part of the bill. Let's start at the end, removal of a public nuisance. You'll see up on line 3.10, the definition is simply the statutory definition of public nuisance. And in essence, that is a piece of property that puts in danger the general public. So maybe a meth house or a crack house or something like that would fall under this definition. Moving backwards, again on line 3.25, reduction of abandoned property. You will see on page 2.15 is the definition of abandoned property, and that is property which has been abandoned and the governmental authority can't find the owner for it. So it's not just something that's not in use, but rather something that's truly been abandoned. Back on page 3, the definition underlined 3.24, remediation of an environmentally contaminated area is another public use or public purpose, and that is defined on page 2 again, starting on line 2.31. An environmentally contaminated area is a piece of property or an area where more than half of the parcels are contaminated. So the whole area does not have to be contaminated in order for it to be taken, but more than half of the parcels need to be contaminated. That's sub 1, and sub 2, the estimated cost of the remediation, including the investigation, the monitoring, and the testing, needs to exceed 100% of the assessor's estimated market value for the contaminated parcel. So it has to be significantly contaminated. The other option is if a court has ordered a cleanup, that also falls then under the definition of environmentally contaminated. And that is on line 3.6 through 3.9. And then finally, the last public use definition is to mitigate a blighted area. And this is probably the most controversial portion of the public use definition. Again, if you turn back to page 2, you will see the definition of blighted area. It starts on line 2.19. The blighted area means, at the time of the condemnation, in area number 1, and here's the first change in the amendment. Rather than that is zoned and used for urban use, we've simply changed it to read that is in urban use, and that is the purpose of that is to clear up some confusion over other areas of the law, but it doesn't change the meaning. So it has to be something that's in urban use, so there are buildings around, and more than 50% of the buildings, here's another change in the amendment, we've added located in the area, just to clarify, are dilapidated. And you will see then below that the definition for dilapidated buildings. And a dilapidated building means, number one, that a building has to have been cited for a building code violation at least a year prior. Number two, the code violation hasn't been remedied by the owner of the property. And number three, as of the date the condemnation is commenced, the building has to be structurally substandard. And if you turn to the next page, we have the definition of structurally substandard, starting on line 3.29. And it means a building has code violations relating to one of the laundry list of things that have to do with the actual structure of the building. And then on page 4, line 4.3, we have another piece of language that says it has to be significant. The estimated cost of satisfying that structurally substandard code violation has to exceed 50% of the assessor's estimated market value for it to fall under this broad definition of blight. Here's another amendment, Mr. Chairman. If you turn back to page 2 under dilapidated buildings, at the end of line 2.30, we added a couple of sentences, and that's line 1.7 in the amendment. And it simply states that a local government has the right to seek a search warrant upon a showing of probable cause that a code violation has occurred and hasn't been remedied. And that's simply to address some of the concerns that the League of Cities has brought up about this language and said we need to make sure we have something in place that allows us to determine whether a code violation is in place or not. All right, we can move now from the definitions to page 4. Section 3, starting on line 4.7. If you remember, I stated that in order to take an area that is environmentally contaminated or blighted, you need to show that more than 50% of the parcels or buildings are either dilapidated or environmentally contaminated. It means you can take non-contaminated or non-dilapidated buildings or parcels. As long as you can show, and this is where this language comes in, that it's absolutely necessary to do so in order to remediate the blight or remediate the environmental contamination. Section 4, line 4.24, that is the attorney's fee provision. We've made two or three changes in this, but in essence, what this says is that if a property owner challenges a taking by government and wins, the government has to pay the property owner's attorney's fees. And a win is defined in two different ways. Subdivision B there simply says if the court says there's no public use here and the government can't take your property at all, obviously that's a win, and the government has to pay your attorney's fees. Subdivision A says that if the issue is over how much the individual property owner is going to be paid, a win is a property owner that gets more than 20% of the last written offer of a governmental entity. And so at that point, then the governmental entity would have to pay the attorney's fees. If I could just point out, I think we have three changes in this, in my amendment. If you look at line 4.26, we eliminated the words or by the parties themselves. What the language as it was drafted, and this was never my intent, but the language said that if either there's an award of 20% greater or the parties agree in settlement to 20% greater, then the governmental entity has to pay the attorney's fees. And it was never my intention to require attorney's fees to be paid if the property owner actually agrees to the settlement amount. So we've taken out or by the parties themselves. And then at the end of line 4.30, we've added two sentences, both of which I think are significant. The first sentence says, the final judgment or award of damages shall be determined as of the date of taking. This language is intended to address a concern that has arisen in a couple of different committees about the inflation of property values over time. So in other words, if a government starts the process and makes their final written offer and there's a judgment rendered a year later, the argument is the value of the property may have risen in itself 20%, and that's not fair. And so what we're saying is what the courts or the commissioners have to look at is the award of damages at the time of the actual taking, which probably would be right about the same time or just shortly after that written offer was made. It deals with the inflationary issue. And then the second sentence we're adding is that no attorney's fees shall be awarded under this paragraph if the final judgment or award of damages does not exceed $5,000. And this is a very significant change because what we're trying to get at are strip takings, small and mid-sized strip takings. There is a lot of concern about a small strip taking that may be worth a few hundred or a couple thousand dollars and how quickly you could get 20% more of that in a judgment because you're only talking about a few hundred bucks. So we have excluded from this attorney fee provision strip takings or any sort of taking that is $5,000 or less, or that is less than $5,000. That's the attorney fee provision, Mr. Chairman. On page 5, actually, there's one more piece here. This is a different issue, line 5.6. What we have said is that if government is going to take property for economic development using one of those four exceptions that we talked about, such as mitigation of blight or environmental contamination or abandonment, they have to prove that they are falling under the public use definition by clear and convincing evidence in court. Right now, the standard is essentially substantial deference is what courts use right now to the city or to the county or to the government entity in determining public use. And the courts have applied that as being almost complete deference. If the government entity can make a straight-faced argument that this is for a public use, then the standard is they win. This changes that completely and says now it's the burden of the government to prove by a very high standard, clear and convincing evidence, that this is for a public use. And I think that's exactly where the burden belongs. Section 6, line 5.11, compensation for removal of legal nonconforming use. This was added in a committee, and I think it was the Public Safety Committee, and frankly it came up because of billboards. And what the piece says is that if a government comes in and requires that a property owner who wants a permit or a license for legal use requires the removal of a legal nonconforming use, such as a billboard, for example, it is considered a taking and they have to pay for it. It doesn't say they can't do it. It just says they have to pay for it. Section 7 of the regulatory takings, line 5.21.
Okay, I lost.
Oh, this is the historic, this was an amendment added by Representative Earhart in the last committee that said that if a government is going to take property by declaring it a historical use, therefore not allowing the owner of the property to make any changes or do some of the things they want, that is also considered a taking. And I know there's been some controversy about that, and there are some discussions hopefully going on right now about what we ought to do with that language. But that has to do with historic preservation. Section 8, line 5.28, this is the going concern or loss of going concern provision. And what it says is that if government takes business property, and this is a complete taking, this is not a partial taking, if the property is destroyed through a taking, then the assumption now is that the property owner is going to be paid going concern. And that means not just the value of the land and the building, but actually the value of the business going forward. If there is a loss in that business because of their relocation, maybe there is a significant or unique value to the company in being where they are, and if you move them somewhere else, they're going to lose that value. That is now going to be assumed to be given to the property owner, and it is the burden of the government to prove by clear and convincing evidence that they should not get the going concern value of their business property. Section 9, 6.23, compensation for loss of access. This was added on in one of the committees, I can't recall which one, and actually dealt with some examples that people had brought forth regarding gas stations in particular. And it says that if access is cut off through an imminent, through rerouting, for example, or building of roads, and more than 51% of a business's access driveway into their business is cut off, and because of that, more than 50% of their business is lost in the following year, then that is also considered a taking and payment must be made for that. Section 10, starting on line 6.34 and going over to page 7, this piece simply says that when an owner has to relocate, the amount of damages payable at a minimum must be sufficient for an owner to purchase a comparable property in the community and not less than the deposit that was paid by the government. 7.6, section 11, the condemning authority can't require the owner to accept as part of the compensation any substitute or replacement property. If the owner doesn't want it, they actually have to be paid money for the property. Section 12 is the public service corp exception that I already talked about. 7.13, section 13 are some changes in the process. And I don't think this piece has been controversial at all. I think most people agree on this. It simply requires that if a local government is going to take through eminent domain, they actually have to have a public hearing and a public vote on that taking. Section 14, line 8.11, this is the right of first refusal, and essentially what it says is that if government takes a piece of property for a public use and later decides they're not going to use it for public use, the original owner of the property has the right to buy it back at the same price that they were paid for it. They have the right of first refusal. Again, if the governmental entity decides not to use it for a public use any longer. There are three changes in my amendment to this piece. The first change is before the A on line 8.12, we've simply added the language notwithstanding sections 1.61, 161.23 and some other provisions that deal with the process that MnDOT uses to sell back properties. And we don't want to interfere with that if that's just something that really has nothing to do with eminent domain. So we don't want to interfere with that, and that's why we've added that language. And then in subdivision B, we've made three different changes. On line 8.17, we've added the following. It says now, if the former owner cannot be located, and we've added after a due and diligent search, because we want to make sure that there is actually an attempt to find them, or declines to repurchase the property, the condemning authority, and we've changed that to read the attorney for the condemning authority shall prepare a certificate attesting to the same. And this was, I believe, I think this matches us up possibly with Senate language. And then we've added a sentence to the end of subdivision B, and that sentence reads, a recorded certificate to that effect is prima facie evidence that the right of first refusal has terminated. I believe this matches us up with the Senate and says that if the government cannot find the owner, as long as they attest to that in a certificate, that then is good evidence that there's no right to first refusal any longer and the government can move on. Section 15, line 8.21, this is language that Representative Marquardt asked to be added that simply says the Attorney General's office will create a document that explains the rights of property owners and the obligations of government under this new law and make it available to the public. And section 16 is the end. We simply change reference to the right of eminent domain to the power of eminent domain, since that is what it is. It's not a right. And we have effective date, which is a piece, by the way, that we are still looking at. We may have some language on that soon. Mr. Chairman, that's the bill with... Oh, and I'm sorry. I forgot to mention one thing which Representative Solberg pointed out. We actually did take out the language that Representative Wagenius was talking about, the no implied authority language, because apparently it was brought up that this just doesn't happen, so it's not a concern.
Okay. Members, let's see. I've got some questions from some members, and then I think we'll take up your amendment, Representative Johnson. I've got Representative Rukavina, then Dorman, then Walker. Representative Rukavina.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, I know when they were putting a rerouting Highway 53 in my district just north of Virginia, a number of businesses were bought out, and the businesses' concerns were similar to what you're addressing in the compensation for loss of going concern. But at that time, the Department of Transportation told me they couldn't compensate a business for, you know, forcing them to move. That's tough luck. So now with this in your bill, is there an estimate from the Department of Transportation what the cost is going to be extra for building highways in the state?
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Johnson,
Representative Rukavina, there is, and my guess is you probably have that in your packet, but their estimate, and I have some quibble with their estimate, but nonetheless, we've talked quite a bit about it, and their estimate is that starting in your fiscal year 07, it'll be $7 million a year.
And then, Mr. Chair,
Representative Rukavina,
Representative Johnson, would that also include then the Section 9 for the loss for access, because one of the businesses, they were going to leave there, but the... Now the highway was going to be a quarter mile away from business, and they said that didn't make any difference at all. They put a sign up on the new highway.
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rukavina, to be honest, I can't recall if this fiscal note was made before or after we added that amendment, but I know this includes going concern and the attorney's fee provision, which is actually a big bulk of this $7 million.
Representative Dorman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair Johnson. Section 14, the right of first refusal. Curious about the current fair market value of this. Who sets that? How do you determine that?
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry, where are you looking, Representative Dorman?
Section 14 of the bill, the right of first refusal, say a guy wants to get the property back, and you're going to pay the original price or the current fair market value of the property, whichever is lower.
Right.
Who determines the current fair market value of the property?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dorman, my guess is that the governmental entity would make that determination based upon the assessed value of the property, but that language is in there to actually protect the property owner so that if government actually did something to the property to make it even less valuable, the property owner should not have to pay the original price for it. That's the thought behind that piece.
Representative Dorman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Hypothetically, if it went through the process and end up with a settlement above the fair market value, then they don't use it, and the guy's going to come in and buy it back, then you buy it back at fair market value, showing a gain on that. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Johnson.
Representative Dorman, the way it would work is if the property was taken, it actually has to be taken through eminent domain. And so if it's taken through eminent domain and the amount that was paid was above fair market value, then the 2 years later or 6 months later or 7 years later, what the government would look at is, here's what Mr. Johnson paid for the property, and here's what the current fair market value is now, and the lower price is the option for the property owner. I don't know if that answers your question.
No, it answers it.
All right. Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Johnson, my question is in Section 2, I think Subdivision 6 under the blighted area, that description of urban, what is the definition?
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to call on Ms. Shalander if she's here, because I believe this is taken from the TIF statute, but I'm not positive.
Welcome to the Committee on Ways and Means. Can you state your name for the record and give us your testimony?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Alyssa Shalander. I represent the Minnesota Auto Dealers Association. Representative Walker, we have not defined the term urban use in the bill, but that particular section was modeled off of the terms that are used in Chapter 469 in the TIF statute, where they talk about an area being in urban use. And I think all we were meaning by that is that there are buildings and improvements, that it's not rural land, although there could be urban use in rural Minnesota. It just has to be in a city.
Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So we're talking about regional centers, suburban areas, and the two major cities.
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Walker, yes, I would say that probably would be the case. There may be some non-regional centers that would be considered urban, such as their downtown area.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Walker.
Mr. Chair, can we get clarification from Council, since this is dealing with the TIF statute?
Council, can you give us some guidance on this? Does urban area include all of my city of St. Cloud, or just part of it? And how about if I go out to Rockville in my district? Is Rockville urban?
Mr. Chair and Representative Walker, I think as the witness has said, that the bill doesn't tie it to anything in particular, and their thinking behind it as to where they were looking gives some indication of the intent, but there is no specific definition.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Johnson, I think moving along, you might want to think about that. We pass laws all the time with good intentions. And I believe that the intent to make sure that we're not dealing with cornfields and other valuable agricultural land is important. But I think without that clarification, and when you put in that some of the smaller towns or smaller cities and their downtown areas, that could be, that couldn't be, I think that's just too murky.
Sure. Mr. Chairman, that's a fair comment. Let's take a look at that.
Representative Solberg.
Mr. Chair, I want to follow up a little bit on Section 9 and the compensation for loss of access. Does that also include the loss of, or could it also include the loss of access during construction?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Johnson.
Representative Solberg, I have to read through this quickly because this wasn't my amendment, but
I understand the intent. If the building is done, the constructing of the road is done, and I don't have an access to my business, therefore I lose the business. But sometimes we hear an awful lot of complaints about how they're building the road in front of my place, and the traffic can't get into my business. And, council says it's actions permanently. So if I'd read it, I'd answer my own question. Then I'll answer the second question. Is that something that we should consider at some point? And that's a rhetorical question. You don't need to answer. My other question, Mr. Chair, if I may,
yes,
is the standard that you have. Right now, I think you've got four standards. You have the lowest one that's in that, and that's kind of the authority of the governmental agency is the standard. Then we would go to, above that would be preponderance of evidence, and clear and convincing, and then beyond a reasonable doubt. And you've gone to the clear and convincing. Have you thought of going to the preponderance of evidence?
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Solberg, we have discussed that a lot, and I believe the Senate may have done that. They may have dropped it to preponderance of the evidence. My thought is the clear and convincing are two places in the bill. One is with respect to the loss of going concern piece, so the valuation piece. The other is only when it comes to what you might call economic development takings, probably a private-to-private taking. And We've had this discussion. I like the high standard of clear and convincing evidence, and I recognize it's a very high standard. We do use it elsewhere in the law, even in the civil law. And to me, if you are talking about taking someone's property, and we're talking about a constitutional issue here now in the Fifth Amendment to the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, taking it so that someone else can benefit and transferring it to another private entity, I like the very high standard of clear and convincing evidence.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I don't doubt you on that point, and you're giving it from one private to another private. But I'm talking about, I guess, expressing a little bit of concern about clear and convincing for, let's say, I'm building a road. And it seems to me that maybe the standard should be considered a preponderance of evidence for that type of standard for what is strictly for a public use.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Dawson,
and Representative Solberg, that doesn't change in this bill. We've only applied the clear and convincing to the economic development sorts of takings, as opposed to the traditional public uses.
Thank you for that clarification.
Members, I've got a couple of amendments here, including one from someone that's got to leave to go to another committee. I also have Representative Otremba up next. I'm wondering, are there any other questions to the A-74 amendment issues, or otherwise I'd maybe offer the A-74 amendment. We can go to one other amendment that a member has here who has to leave. This was the author's amendment. The chair will move the A-74 amendment. Any discussion to the A-74 amendment? Author went through this, I think, pretty much in the bill. All in favor of the A-74 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The A-74 amendment is adopted. Okay, let me go to Representative Holberg quickly because she has an amendment she needs to offer and then leave. And then Representative Otremba, if I can have you be patient, we'll go back to you. Representative Holberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. This is an amendment that I have talked to the bill author about. It actually was an issue. I was lucky enough to hear this bill on both local government and transportation finance. The issue was discussed in both committees, and it has to do with taking private property to access another property. And so this is the use of eminent domain for road purposes, unless the property to be accessed was landlocked.
Representative Holberg, when you say landlocked, what do you mean by landlocked?
In other words, that they didn't have access to another road currently.
Okay, so this would say...
So in other words, if property A had road access on its west side, it wouldn't be able to condemn property on the east to bring a road through there.
Okay.
They already had access to a road.
Discussion of the A-75 amendment. Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Holberg, I actually have an issue just like this in my district. When you say access property that is landlocked, if it has access it to a road, but the practicality of it is that a road can't be built up the hill, but it does have access to another road, you know, so you can walk to the property or maybe some kind of a vehicle. Would that be considered in this case then? Because what they're doing is they're taking the land from one private property owner on the other side of the lot, and they're going to punch a road in, and one property owner is going to make a ton of money. And what would happen in that case with your amendment?
Well, Representative Holberg.
Mr. Chair, in the case of this amendment, I guess they'd have to mitigate the hill or put in a retaining wall or whatever to... put the access through the property to the road that they already abutted.
And Representative Holberg, I assume it would be the same thing if you had access. Let's say you have a 40-acre piece of property and you got a wetland on one side of it and a road next to the wetland, and you'd have to put a road through the wetland to get to the other property. You'd say that you had access to that property even though you had to put the road through the wetland and mitigate it, correct?
That would be correct. Again, the premise here is that one property owner should not suffer for the gain of another.
Okay. Representative Johnson, do you have a comment on the amendment?
Mr. Chairman, I'm fine with this amendment.
You're fine with the amendment?
Yes.
Representative, Carlson.
Yeah,
of the author of the amendment, Mr. Chairman, I'm just, like I suppose everybody, trying to figure out what kind of impact this would have. And something that comes to my mind in my area when we were dealing with some road work, it was the issue of trucks going through a neighborhood and then providing access in a way that would avoid the trucks having to go through a residential area. And I'm a little concerned that the amendment might block the opportunity to correct traffic patterns, because technically there would have been access to another road, but less than desirable on the part of a lot of people having semis or other medium-sized trucks going through a neighborhood.
And Representative Holbert.
Mr. Chair, and Representative Carlson, from what I gather from the situation, then you would prefer that another property owner have to give up their property, the trucks to go there, rather than on roads that were already established?
Well, it,
Representative Carlson.
It kind of preempts some local decision-making in terms of what might be, that's my concern. I'm not trying to come down one way or the other. I'm just trying to create a, or get an explanation as to what would happen when a city wants to make sure traffic patterns are such that you don't create safety hazards in a neighborhood or undue noise. You know, we're making a judgment here in St. Paul that might impact on the local city's ability to control traffic patterns.
And Mr.
Representative
Holbrook. I'm bringing this amendment on behalf of another member of the House who's not on this committee. And so, of course, no good deed goes unpunished, as you know. But certainly if there was some mitigating language that Representative Carlson would like to bring forward to discuss, I'm sure before we get to the floor, you know, we could address those types of concerns. So the basic premise is that just because it might be more economically feasible to run a road across somebody's property if a particular parcel already has access to a road, then we should avoid the taking of somebody else's property for that purpose.
And Mr. Chairman, maybe we can talk about this further then. But the more I think about it, and I hadn't seen this amendment before, really what we're talking about is some safety issues. And maybe that's where we can do something to make sure that we at least cover safety issues. I don't think anybody would want to have heavy trucks going through a neighborhood with small children playing and that kind of thing if there were another alternative.
Well, and
Representative Holbrook,
but we can talk
about when I was in the city council, streets are not for playing.
Representative Holbrook, I assume that if you've got a piece of property that's already got access to a road and then a city decides that they need another road, oh, I don't know, two blocks over on the other piece of property for traffic patterns because traffic on the first road is growing, that just because this piece of property already has access to a road doesn't mean that they couldn't put the road through if there was some other reason for putting the road through.
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Mr. Chairman, what I'm,
Representative Carlson,
what I'm talking about was a situation that developed with or at least some of the Metro folks might know, the Highway 100 upgrade. And when that took place, access to Highway 100 became more restricted. And so there were a group of businesses along there that formerly had direct access to Highway 100 but no longer did. And that was forcing the trucks back in through a residential neighborhood. And I agree with Representative Holbrook that streets aren't to play with or play on, but small children sometimes cross those streets back and forth. And it was having an impact on a residential area that one could argue might have some safety issues, but I'm satisfied with Representative Holbrook or whomever the amendment is brought on behalf of to see if maybe something can't be done to make sure that safety issues are somehow addressed. If that could be part of the criteria, then I would be happy.
Well, the other thing, I guess, Representative Holbrook, I know you've got to go to a meeting. I've got other people raising their hands to talk about this issue. Would you like to lay that amendment over? I suspect we're going to be back here an hour from now when your committee is over with. We may be here after session. There's a number of amendments that are coming up. Would you be willing to lay this over for a bit till you can get back?
Mr. Chair, that's fine.
Okay. The A-75 amendment is temporarily laid over. Okay, next, who's got the next amendment here? We adopted the A-74 amendment. Okay. Representative Kelleher.
There are other questions.
Hey, Mr. Chair.
Representative Kelleher moves the A-06-1453 amendment.
Well, Mr. Chair and members and Representative Johnson, this amendment would, I believe, clarify the issue of compensation for loss on going concern. And the issue here is the standard that you are putting into place, and I don't change that standard in terms of clear and convincing evidence, but I do think that in reading the bill and talking with a number of folks, the issue here is the burden that you put on the condemning authority, the issue is they do not have access to information to compensate adequately on the loss. And so my amendment would clarify that 90 days before the commencement of the commission hearing to determine the damages, the owner needs to provide the condemner with true and complete copies of income tax returns, financial statements, pending liabilities, real property leases for the past 5 years preceding the filing of the petition. And I think that this, you know, gets to what you are proposing here and does it in a way that then actually a really fair outcome can happen. And I think that's really one of the main issues with the way it's currently written is the condemning authority would really have no way of knowing these things. I don't know any private business that would just open up their books otherwise, and if that's the thought that the language currently provides for that, it clearly doesn't. So I think we need to clarify this so that people can really come to an adequate agreement.
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Representative Kelleher. We actually, this amendment came up in the last committee or committee before that, and I didn't support it, and I still don't. What I tried to do, I think this is very broad, especially when you start talking about complete copies of income tax returns and financial statements. What I tried to do is add language that would address the concern that the government is not going to have enough information to counter the assumption of going concern. And we did that in two ways. First of all, this was always in there, but if a property owner is going to argue that they deserve going concern, they have to put the government on notice at least 60 days before the first hearing. And then in Subdivision 4, this is something that we added in the last committee to address this issue at least somewhat, and that is the appraisal. The property owner has never had the obligation to turn over their appraisal prior to a hearing. Now they do. This says that if you want to use an appraisal, you have to turn that over to the government. And if a property owner is going to argue that they deserve going concern, their appraisal is going to have to address that because that's going to have to be part of the appraisal amount. So I think we've addressed this issue maybe not quite as broadly as some would like, but I do believe that the information is there, and I don't support the amendment.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Kelleher.
Mr. Chair and members, I think it's not about broadening it. It's actually about narrowing it so the actual intent can be followed through with on the law here. It's not about broadening this particular section. It's actually about narrowing it down so that people can provide the information that Representative Johnson believes that they are going to provide in their appraisal, which I don't really see necessarily happening. In fact, what we're doing without the amendment, the condemning authority would be required to disprove damages without access to any financial information pertaining to the claim. And so I think this is just, I mean, really, I hope members will support it. I think it really is about common sense here in terms of making this bill slightly better than it currently is.
Any other discussion to the Kelleher amendment? Seeing no further discussion, the vote recurs on the A-06-1453 amendment. All in favor of the Kelleher 1453 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
The chair is in doubt. All in favor, raise your hands. All opposed, raise your hands. By a vote of 11 ayes and 15 nays, the Kelleher Amendment is not adopted. All right, members, I had mistakenly jumped over Representative Otremba. I'm very sorry, Representative Otremba. I told you I was going to try to get the Holberg Amendment in, and I'd go back to you, and I forgot about you. So, Representative Otremba.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Johnson. In the Ag Committee, we talked about transmission lines and pipelines. Did that issue get worked out, or are we still working on it?
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Otremba, they are exempted from the bill. And there was a little bit of discussion in Ag. I think Representative, I can't remember who brought it up, but...
Well,
it was Hamilton. Yeah, there you go. And I think he brought it up more as a statement than anything else. So I have not had any... Okay. Recent discussions with on that issue.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson, my last recollection of what was said at the committee meeting was that Erdahl and Hamilton and some of the other of us would like to look at that issue, and so I would appreciate that before the bill comes to a final vote.
Okay.
Thank you.
I'd be happy to do that.
All right. I was going to call on another member who's having a discussion here, so let me go to, here comes another amendment. Okay. Well, should we go back to the Representative Holberg's amendment? Representative Holberg, let's bring back up the A-75 amendment. Representative Holberg moves the A-75 amendment. And with some additional language on it, that page 1, line 6, after the word landlocked, the following is added, or it can be shown that the road is necessary to mitigate ongoing safety concerns. Representative Holberg, do you want to speak to that amendment?
Mr. Chair, this is a dangerous thing to try and fix things on the fly here, but in discussions with Representative Carlson, he expressed and would probably be willing to confirm it's a good first step and that we can polish it up as it moves to the floor.
Representative Johnson, do you have any comments on that?
Mr. Chairman, that's fine with me.
Representative Riccovina.
Well, Mr. Chair, I got a little polishing to do on it, too, because I'm concerned and talking to council that landlocked doesn't mean water access, which we changed last year because of a court decision. So I just want to make sure, being that this is going to override statute in a lot of places, dealing with eminent domain and that we don't somehow screw up the fact that last year we had to change state law because the DNR wouldn't give somebody an access because they said they had water access, and we've changed a lot of state. Water access is not an access. And I'm afraid with the landlocked, it might somehow some attorney's going to, you know, take this thing and make a few hundred grand off of it or something. So I want to work with Representative Holberg on that, too. And we'll cross-reference where we changed it to say that landlocked means landlocked.
Representative Holberg, I just going to ask you, it's your sense that, let's say I own a piece of property that's got a river or a creek or something running through it, that this does not create a situation where I am denied access to the other part of the property just because the river is there.
Mr. Chair, I guess I'm not clear on your scenario, what you're talking
okay.
about.
Okay, remember, Representative Riccovina, do you want to bring up your concern again?
Chair, what I'm saying is here's what happened. Two, 3 years ago, a guy had a piece of property on the far side of a lake. Because there was a DNR boat landing on the other side of the lake, he couldn't use the access issue, which has been in Minnesota law for 100 and some years. Because the DNR all of a sudden said landlocked meant landlocked, and if you got water access, therefore, you can drive across the lake and haul your concrete and lumber and everything else. Well, we changed that. But now with the wording here, I'm just afraid that some a good attorney, a Philadelphia lawyer, will say that all of a sudden it's back to you can drive across the lake, tough luck, you don't have.
I guess,
the
question, Representative Holbert, is let's say I own 40 acres and let's say I've got a stream that runs through the middle of it and I have a road on one side of the 40 acres but not the other. Is the other side of the 40 acres that doesn't have a road access landlocked, or am I considered to have access to it because I've got access to my property?
Mr. Chair, would it be your intent to negatively impact your neighbor as opposed to building a bridge?
Representative Holbert, I'm not talking about building a bridge or negatively impacting my neighbor. I'm just curious what your amendment does.
Mr. Chair,
Well, I shouldn't really say it's your amendment, Representative Holbert. I know it's someone else's fault.
I appreciate that, Mr. Chair. And the way that it is written, it would be my belief that because you had access on the property that was on one side of your stream, you would not be able to use eminent, or the road authority would not be able to use eminent domain to access the other half of your property to somebody else's.
Okay, any other discussion? Representative Clark.
I was wondering, I guess maybe I should ask Representative Holbert, is the idea here, let's say for example there was a 20-acre parcel and there was that was located back off a road, and that local township or county had said you can only develop 20-acre parcels, you can't develop 5-acre, or you can develop, 5 or 10-acre parcels. Would this allow that road then to be built in to allow that 20-acre parcel to be split up into 5-acre parcels? And my question is, are we, by this, making lots more small development possibilities? Is that part of your goal, or is that...
Representative Holbert.
Mr. Chair and Representative Clark, if your 20-acre parcel of property was currently landlocked, then you, under my amendment, you could use eminent domain to access it. The size of the parcels that you could have would be a function of the zoning, not the function of whether or not you could get a road there.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Clark.
Some of the zoning I know says that the only way you could, you have to have 30 feet on a road, on a public road, and then you can, you know, develop it as a parcel. If you don't have that, it seems like what you're doing then is you're making more public roads for more development in places that might have been more remote.
Mr. Chair, I think, in fact, we would be having less roads.
Less roads?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Clark.
Why would you be having less roads? It says if you can show that it's landlocked, you can put a road there, whereas right now there's no road there.
But,
so you'd have,
you can do that. But Representative Clark, the intent is that if you were not landlocked, that you would build another road across somebody else's property in addition to the road you already accessed. And that's what I'm trying to stop, which would be more roads, not less roads.
But, Mr. Chairman?
Representative Clark.
Maybe I'm not being very clear. I'm talking about where there is not a road. Okay, there's not a road to a piece of land that is landlocked. And that land is not being developed because it is landlocked.
You can do it.
And so this would create more development of parcels within land that right now is not... does not have road access. That's my understanding.
No, Mr. Chair.
Representative Riccovino.
Mr. Chair, I think I hope Representative Clark, there for 150 years there's been state statute that says if you have over 5 acres of land, nobody can stop you from getting to it. Private landowner has to give you easement. That's been on the books for 150 years. Representative Holbert's amendment is making it harder to get to it. So she's actually, I think, going with your line of thought, which is don't ever develop it. But she's making it harder than I think under, well, at least the same.
Okay, Representative Holbert.
Mr. Chair, what I'm trying to do is that if you are a property owner and your land that you own has access, direct access to a road that you're not allowed to instead, for example, you could, rather than use the road that you have access to, you could back that out into the backside of a cul-de-sac, consume all of your land for building lots with one little fishtail going out to a road through an abutting private property owner's property to build the access. So you maximize your ability to build houses and you impose the land use of the road access on another property owner.
All right. Is there any other discussion to the A75 amendment as amended by Representative Holberg?
I've got
Representative Rucavina.
I've got some language to make it better than counsel written up for me.
All right. Counsel.
Mr. Chair and Representative Rucavina, on line 1.6 after the period, insert, a property that has no access other than over a navigable waterway is landlocked.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Holberg.
Appropriate, I can incorporate that into my amendment.
Okay, so Representative, Ms. Dyson, does that still would include the safety language that she had previously added, correct?
It would come after that.
All right. Okay, just so we all know what we're voting on, Ms. Dyson, can you read the amendment with the new language?
Mr. Chair and members, the amendment now reads, a road authority must not acquire property by eminent domain to establish a road for access to property unless it is landlocked or it can be shown that the road is necessary to mitigate ongoing safety concerns. A property that has no other access than over a navigable waterway is landlocked.
Representative Johnson, any last comments?
No, Mr. Chairman, that's fine.
You know, we normally don't take testimony, but I see someone here has a comment on this. Mr. Carlson, would you like to come forward?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Keith Carlson. I'm the Executive Director of the Metropolitan Intercounty Association. That includes 13 counties, 8 of those in greater Minnesota. I strongly urge those members, particularly from suburban and ex-urban and rural Minnesota, to think strongly about what this amendment actually says. For those of you in suburban, ex-urban areas that are rapidly developing, that are having major commercial or industrial developments, what this amendment says is that if a major parcel where development is planned on is served by any road whatsoever, you can't build new roads unless it's in order to improve the safety of that access to that property. If the road does not improve the safety, but substantially improves the traffic management in that area, which I think any of you can imagine what we're talking about, it can't be built under this if it would require the use of eminent domain to acquire that new right-of-way. For those of you in rural Minnesota, those of you in southern Minnesota are used to the fact that there's a road about every section line. So there's a road in about every 1 mile in a crisscross patterns. For those of you in northern Minnesota, that's not necessarily the case. So using the effect of this on in the southern Minnesota area where there is a road in about every section line, if the county wants to build a new road to a parcel that fronts along a parcel that has a road on the opposite end of it, a mile away, anybody can block it by saying it's already served by a road even though access is over a mile away. When you get into northern Minnesota, when there aren't even that density of roads, this is literally saying that road access is going to be significantly reduced by this amendment, regardless of the density of the future development on that parcel. So if somebody is building or planning on doing development on one side of a parcel, but way on the other side of it, there's a road, This basically says you can't use eminent domain to acquire the property to do it. I urge the committee to defeat this amendment to think strongly about what its implications are. You've already had some debate about what it means. I suggest to you it's much, much broader reaching than what you think.
Representative Holdard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Again, this is a question of who is going to be damaged and who is going to benefit from the use of eminent domain. And I'm not sure in some of the examples given by Mr. Carlson if you could even use eminent domain under this new law if it was relative to economic development purposes. But again, why should one property owner have to suffer so another one gains?
Other discussion? I think we're ready to vote. All in favor of the A-75 Holbrook Amendment with the additional language that was read by Council Dyson, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. All right, members. Let's go to the A-76 amendment. Is this Representative Vandeveer, I believe, moves the A-76 amendment. Representative Vandeveer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, this is what this amendment does. It simply says that because currently there are some ordinances that will not allow an owner who has two non-conforming lots right next to each other to build on it, although if, for example, me and Representative McNamara owned a lot next to me, both lots were buildable. If he sold one to me, if he sold his lot to me, then that lot would not be buildable. And so this just says that you can't have an ordinance that does that. And it's very specific to Shoreland Residential and very specific to not the commercial property. So it's been restricted quite a bit. It also states that it doesn't change any lot that's currently not buildable or make that buildable, but it just says that you can't base the buildability on ownership. And members, the reason I bring this amendment here is because it was it did pass out of the Environment Committee with the stipulation that we continue to work with the interest groups on coming to an agreement, but that bill did not get a hearing in the Senate, and so in order to keep it alive, I'd like to put it into this bill because it does fit.
So I'm sorry, Representative Vandeveer, what you're saying this does is, let's say there are two pieces of property next to each other on a lake, and one of them, let's say that the lake has now adopted, I don't know, an ordinance or the county has it, you got to have 100-foot lots, but you have an old 75-foot lot that was grandfathered in that if Representative Gunther, who owns the lot next to you, wants to sell it to me and have me build a home there, I can build it. But if you want to sell it to Representative Vandeveer, your next-door neighbor, then you would not be able to build on, and this says you'd still be able to. Is that right,
that
Representative
Vandeveer? That is correct.
Okay. Representative Aguinas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Vandeveer, when this was discussed in Environment Committee, I thought we were left with the understanding that you were going to work with DNR and come up, because there was some acknowledged problem, but thought that this way overdrew the problem, that you and DNR were going to come up with a solution, and I was wondering if DNR agrees to this solution, or if there is more work that needs to be done between you and DNR.
Representative Vandeveer.
Mr. Chair, the DNR does not agree with this solution, I don't even know if they've looked at it, but this is simply because we do not have the bill that left Environment, because it did not get a hearing in the Senate.
Representative Williams.
So am I to take it you have not discussed this with DNR since our Environment hearing?
Representative Vandeveer.
Mr. Chair, and Representative Virginia said is correct. We do have a meeting to talk about it tomorrow.
Representative Virginia.
Mr. Chairman, I think that it would be in the wise for us to wait until those discussions with DNR and Representative Vanderveer went forward, and that we addressed this issue on the floor rather than having a long discussion about this here because of some unintended consequences of this particular draft, since it hasn't been worked on yet with DNR, and we still have an opportunity on the floor to do that. And I would hope that Representative Vanderveer could see that.
Representative Johnson, do you have any comments on this amendment?
Not really, Mr. Chairman.
You've been through six or seven committees and you haven't seen this amendment?
I have not seen this.
I thought you'd seen everyone.
Representative Vanderveer did mention this to me, but unfortunately we didn't have much of a chance to talk about it. So I'm going to leave this one up to you folks.
All right. Other discussion to the Vanderveer amendment? Seeing no further discussion, all in favor of the A-76 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Chairs in doubt, all in favor, raise their hands. Opposed, raise your hands. By a vote of 12 to 12, the amendment fails. The amendment is not adopted. All right. I have the A-66 amendment. Is there an author here for the A-66 amendment?
Then you'd vote.
Is there someone moving the A-66 amendment? I know that this amendment was supposedly brought by someone who's not on the committee. I thought there might be someone else moving it. Seeing no one, I'll lay it aside unless someone wants to move it. Are there any other amendments? Seeing no other amendments. Any discussion to the bill as amended? Representative Rucavino.
Sir, I just can't help myself, so I have to ask. Representative Johnson, the way property taxes are going up in this state, they're getting pretty confiscatory on everyone. Are you going to do something to ensure that, that little guy that has that land up on Lake Vermilion that's had it for 70, 80 years in the family, and now the price of it, the property's gone up so much that we're not going to confiscate his property?
Representative Johnson.
Isn't that taking?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rucavina, I think there's a property freeze still out there somewhere that I suppose could address that. I don't know if it's going anywhere, but it's an option.
Well, Representative Rucavina.
Mr. Chair, I don't think it's a property freeze. I think it's tied to the implicit price deflator, which would be 6.3%, I believe it is this year, minus a bunch of other things. But still, on a property, a little point peninsula on Vermilion, the 300-400 feet of lakeshore is worth about $1 million, so that's pretty big jump. So I was just wondering if being that you and Senator Bach are rushing to address the government taking property, that all of these local government aid cuts and non-appropriations to K-12 education and that qualify as the government taking property. That's all. No comment, Representative Johnson.
Representative Johnson.
Was that a comment or a question?
Well, that was a question to you. If you don't consider that confiscatory,
I would be happy to talk with you more about it.
Okay, we'll talk about it on the
defense. All right. Any other discussion to Senate File 2750?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Vanderveer.
I'd like to move to reconsider the A-76 amendment.
Representative Vanderveer moves reconsideration. All in favor of reconsidering the A-76 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. The amendment shall be reconsidered. Representative Vanderveer.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that we just have another member in the room, and keep it quick. We should revote. We probably have two.
All right. Any other discussion to the A76 amendment? All right, everyone's coming into the room. I think we got just about everyone here. All right, let's vote again. All in favor of the A76 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
All right, we'll have the division again. All in favor, raise your hands, and raise them high so we can make sure we got them all.
You're a nice guy. I thought Mary Ellen was.
All opposed, raise your hands. Seeing 13 ayes and 14 nays, the motion does not prevail. The amendment is not adopted. But there was another person in the room, Representative Van Der Veer.
Oh, wow.
All right.
I voted right or wrong.
Any other discussion to the bill? Carol, a newest motion at Senate File 2750, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. The bill is passed.
Thank you.
Members, there will be at least one other meeting this week, maybe two. We've got a number of bills coming forward. I don't have the schedule put together yet, but watch for announcements on the floor in your email. With that, the meeting is adjourned.